Hey, everybody, welcome back to another amazing episode of the best darn show on the internet, the Oversharing Show. We have a guest again today. I'm very excited about that. But before we get into that, I'm going to read today's quote. And the lovely Sharon is going to pull a card like we do every week. Today's quote: the first half of life is devoted to forming a healthy ego. The second half is going inward and letting go of it. And that's by Carl Jung, or Jung, or Jung, or however you say it. However you prefer to say it out there in the internet.
Yes, indeed. I think that...
Are you pulling from the Lord of the Rings, you said, Sharon?
I am. I'm pulling from the Lord of the Rings deck.
All right.
Okay. Here we go. I need to change my screen a little bit here. Okay. Oh, King of Swords.
Ooh. Nice. I like how in this deck the kings aren't seated. It's much different.
Yeah, it's kind of knighty, huh? Because he has a horse. So it's kind of like the Thoth deck.
Yeah, right? Good call there.
Maybe
the Knight of Swords can represents our guest today. I mean,
the Knight or King?
The King. See, I'm already doing it. Because a lot of times people say that court cards can represent people, and air, you know, is all about communication. And our guest today is definitely a communicator. He's got his own YouTube channel. He's a stand-up comedian and all that stuff. And so it is possible. Did you want to say something about the card? Were you going to read it? Or
yeah, it's just comes. Man. It's like this instead of.
Yeah, it's like a big map. Yeah, I love it.
Oh my gosh, where are you, King of Swords? All right, Glorfindel. How do you say his name? Glorfindel.
Glorfindel. Yeah.
Glorfindel. Upright. All right, the mightiest of the elves, Glorfindel, whatever, presides over your reading, appealing to your sense of logic. I was just talking about logic earlier. With his courage and bravery on the battlefield, the King of Swords knows how to compartmentalize his emotions and advises you to follow suit. Honor your intuition, but call forth judgment, reason, and mental acuity. I call forth mental acuity. I kind of need that right now. Reversed. Even the wisest of kings can be manipulated. And when this card is reversed, the King of Swords speaks to corruption. There may be an authority figure in your life seeking to take advantage of you or to use their power to unduly influence a situation. If the King of Swords is you, reconsider how you're using your position. Any thoughts?
Well, you know, like most cards, I think in most books with the tarot, they always give you some kind of good advice or whatever, how to look at it, how to look at whatever card it is that you get. But I think it is kind of synchronistic that we are talking to somebody today who's all about swords, and he definitely doesn't look like he's a spring chicken. Not saying old man, don't worry, I'm older than I look, so I won't pick on you for your age. But so, yeah, I'm really excited. And just to give a little backstory, our good friend Spoons, who everybody that watches the show probably knows who she is. We talk about her all the time. We have a couple of little behind the scenes oversharing members of this podcast that help
contributors.
And she definitely is one of them. And she sent me a video of his not too long ago. And, you know, just in the first 10 or 15 minutes, I was really excited about it because he seems to be talking about a lot of the same kind of topics that we're talking about.
Yes.
And, you know, you could get a lot of different stuff that talks about either spirituality or like truth or all this stuff. But the way it seemed to be framed, the way he was talking about it, it seemed like he was really aware of victim narrative and stuff. And he didn't seem to not be a victim, which I'm really excited about. But without any further ado, I'll introduce our guest. His name is Owen Hunt, a.k.a. Bootsy Greenwood, a.k.a. the Blue Collar Mystic. Coming to the stage, guys, we're having a little joke before, but in classic oversharing fashion, we're going to have him on and we want to ask him, you know, all about his roots and coming up and how he kind of actually came to his worldview that he holds now. So what's going on, Owen? How you doing?
I am doing great. I just am happy to be here. I'm stoked for Spoons to connect us. That's awesome. I need to send her a thank you. And yeah, really excited to overshare a little bit, let's get the prying going, right? Like let me just unzip myself for strangers. I actually
Do
really
it.
enjoy it. I'm a pretty transparent person anyway, so it's not going to be painful, hopefully. There might be some cringe on the other side of this podcast, but I've exposed myself to myself and seen a lot of, yeah, I love that you started out with the Jung quote, the first part of life, developing a healthy ego. And the second is basically a paradox, like everything else. The card was a cool pull too. I love Carl Jung. I haven't read a lot of his books personally, but I recently came across another one of his quotes where he says, "The first 40 years, that me not being a spring chicken of your life, is just research, and life begins actually at 40." And then I think there is some truth to that. It's like,
Oh, yes.
when I look back at my life, it could be very easy to lament or regret certain ways that I've wasted time in my life. I try to avoid that because it's not a healthy mentality to operate from. But that quote particularly, it helps a lot. And I think it probably had taken me 40 years to develop a relatively healthy ego and awareness of myself. So the man is just, he's full of
Brilliant.
wisdom. Yeah, quite brilliant.
Indeed. So we hear that you're a comedian. We hear that you've done all kinds of stuff, traveled around, van life. You've been into music, TV, I don't know, something like that. How did you grow up? Like, where did you grow up? And, did you have like religious influence over you in your youth?
Yeah, all good questions. I grew up in the suburbs, just a very straightforward. We grew up poor, actually. And then my dad became successful. So we became middle class. And it was very easy to see that middle class is just poor with more shit, basically. And, so we moved into another neighborhood and, started going to a different school and all that when I was around sixth or seventh grade. And then my parents split up. They started having some things go on there, and so that was tumultuous. And my sister and I were probably m more closely involved in our parents' breakup than a lot of kids, are. It wasn't very compartmentalized. And I grew up just in that energy of, I guess, just a lot of. A lot of spicy, angry arguments. And then I joke that like my ASMR is like plates breaking in the kitchen. That's how we went to sleep, but I had great influences too. And I have great relationships with both of my parents. They just weren't right for each other. And they got married so young, when I look back at that too, it's crazy, right? Like life beginning at 40. Can you imagine having a kid when you're 19 or 25 or something? Like you just have no idea. So
Exactly.
a lot of that stuff I've integrated. Some of it I'm still working on. But I grew up in the suburbs. One of my biggest influences was my grandfather. He was from the Greatest Generation. He and I played golf together a lot, and he was a big joker. He loved to laugh, and he would make everybody laugh. He'd go to the barber shop. He was bald. I used to rip on him all the time for being bald, and karma's real. But he would go to the barber shop every week, and get his little cul-de-sac clipped, and I would go and hang out with him on the weekends. We go play golf at different state parks and stuff like that. And I learned a lot from him. He taught me how to cuss. One time he hit a ball into the woods and he goes, "Ah, you shit ass." And I was like, "Oh my God, you can do that? You can double up on curse words? Like,
That's
holy
funny.
shit." So yeah, I learned a lot from him. I love my grandmother as well. And we were always really close up until she got a dementia, but I grew up, you know, pretty standard, I would say. I didn't know who I was in seventh grade. It's like, I tried out alt rock and grunge, you know, and then there were the preps back then. There was the preps and the goths and the alt people. And I was somewhere in the middle. You know, my whole life, I've never felt like I really fit into any group. It didn't matter what it was. But I really liked a lot of people from a lot of different groups, and I thought they were all cool. You know, I didn't have a problem with anybody. In high school, they printed my name in the yearbook under my golf picture wrong. So I was immediately an overnight celebrity. Not really probably what you wanted to. My name is Owen Hunt. So they printed my last name with a C under the golf picture. So I became a legend immediately. From the yearbook. And I don't know if that was on purpose. I don't know if I pissed somebody off. I never got to the bottom of that. So I don't think I dated anybody on the yearbook staff or anything that would have, you know, done that on purpose, or if it was literally just a typo. I don't know what happened, but pretty legendary there. And then I went to college. I came to, I did have some religious upbringing. Honestly, we were kind of like always sort of Christian of some sort. My grandmother on my dad's side, who they lived in South Georgia, so I didn't see them as much. She was like a Southern Baptist, which is very staunch, you know. And then whenever my dad would take us to church, sometimes we go to like the Methodist church, Methodist youth group, hang out, and they had cool activities, lock-ins, go into the go-kart track and stuff like that. And that was cool. So I enjoyed that. But then around, I would say when I was 15, 16 years old, my parents were trying to reconcile and keep their relationship together. And one of the things that happened to our family at that point was we started going to this like non-denominational Pentecostal type of church. Not quite handling snakes, but everything else, you know, the prosperity preacher and you know, you name it. And so my dad was in the band at the church and my mom was in the band at the church. They're both musicians. And my dad was a bass player and my mom was a singer always growing up. And so, you know, that led to me being kind of an outcast in high school, right around this, you know, same time as the yearbook thing comes out. And really just trying to find my way. There was definitely some strong spiritual experiences that I had around that time, you know, relating to Jesus. It's still an archetype that I relate to very much. And, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, as far as how people view things. I have a lot of friends who are Christian, or I have a lot of friends who are all kinds of different. Again, I never fit into any group. And
welcome to the Capybara Club.
right. So, I relate to Jesus somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, dude. Is it the hair?
I mean, yeah, every Spanish guy I know calls me DJ Jesus because I'm a wedding DJ. So when I show up to the menu, awesome. Yeah, they're always like, so anyway.
And I always say Brandon's a capybara because he can hang out with all kinds of people from all different kinds of walks of life. And I kind of am this similar way because I grew up like having friends in different circles, but I could never bring them together. Like, because that one was not going to hang out with this one. It just was not going to mesh. So I always kind of had to like have one-on-one friendships with these people. So welcome.
I can definitely relate to that. I've seen some train wrecks where I tried to introduce people again and they just did not get along. And so it's taken me a long time to learn that lesson, you know, but
yeah.
So it was kind of wild going through all the church stuff, the Pentecostal stuff, and speaking in tongues and praying for the sick and all this stuff. Super intense, super duper intense. And like, as I get back into the Yeah, have you? That's cool.
Yeah, and Brandon too. Like, we've all been through that.
That's awesome. I love that we have that in common. Because I don't know, there's a lot of interesting parallels to that. I was just talking to my sister kind of a little bit yesterday about just kind of the overlaps and the parallels. If you look into Crowley's stuff or, you know, any of these other weirdos, that so many of the archangels are the same. That so many of the metaphysical experiences, it all sort of translates over in this weird way. So I think there's definitely a lot to that. These archetypes and these, I don't know what you would call them, like collective identity structures or energy forms or thought forms or whatever. One of the things I usually call these ideas is pendulums. It's just from a book that I did an audio book of that I really liked called Reality Transurfing, which is what kind of got my YouTube thing going in the beginning. It's a Russian mystic book, but it's probably the most down to earth mystical book. And it's, I don't think there's a complete book on all this stuff, but as far as people with the attempt, it is a long one, but it does a good job of outlining a lot of the stuff in a less woo woo way than many others, I would say. But I've always been interested in all that from even the church, you know, miracles and amazing things and having faith. And a yes. lot of that stuff has returned to me. Like a lot of it I rejected too, you know, through my 20s and 30s where, you know, it just, I hated it and I ran away from it. But yeah, it kind of comes back, you know, yes. it's in there.
Well, yeah, because you do have experiences. Like, I mean, I could speak for myself when I was, my mom got into this whole born again Christian thing when I was in about fourth grade. So we went through that for a few years and I saw, you know, like I spoke in tongues. I had these feelings that I've, you know, and then I also saw people get healed, people that I knew get healed from certain things. So for years after, even when I was kind of out of it and done with it, I still kind of thought I was going to go to hell because the experience to me was so real. I'm like, this must be real. And it wasn't until later on when I had to, I guess, recognize, I had to kind of make my worldview meld all together and I could see how it could be real and how things can work from belief and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. that is one of those traps that I see why people can get stuck in it for their whole life. And again, Sharon and I, we don't judge people. You know, if you're a Christian and it's working out for you, that's great, you know. But it's the kind of the negative aspects of some of it is what we focus on. But yeah.
And yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say I too went through the whole like going to this like really religious church, which I call a cult now because it kind of is.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I feel like most churches are, but that's neither here nor there. So yes, and my parents were deacons and they were like prayer warriors, you know, like they would go visit people on their deathbeds. They would go visit people in the hospital. They would go pray for people who are like, I never had a baby before and I want a baby. And my parents would pray for them and boom, they would get pregnant because they were barren or for whatever reason couldn't have children. And so like I heard about the miracles all the time too. I wasn't so much one who would experience things. Like they'd be like, can you feel the Holy Spirit in the church tonight? You know, and I'd be like, no, I don't feel nothing. You know what I mean?
So, I love your honesty.
And Sharon wasn't even, just to break in real quick, Sharon's like the ultimate skeptic. Like she doesn't even get high from smoking weed. So like whenever we've tried supplements and stuff before, she's just like, I don't know, man, I'm not getting it. Everybody's like, what the hell, Sharon? Come on, you got to get it. If you don't get it, it's not real, right? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'd just be like, I mean, I trust that happened to you. I'm not telling you you're a liar, but I don't know what that feels like. So, you know, I just observe and that's all I can really do. But yeah, so I
kind of give honest feedback, which I think most people are so scared of the social pressure that they won't even do that, right? Like yes, they'll just be like, absolutely. Yes, I feel it too. Uh-huh.
Yes, exactly. Very peer pressure. Exactly. Yeah. And some girls that I knew back when, you know, they were like family friends that I grew up with in the church. They were at the time, they're like, you mean you can't feel the Holy Spirit when, you know, whatever? And I'm like, no, I really don't. And they're like, you still believe in God and everything? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I don't need to feel it to believe that there's a God. You know what I mean? I don't know. It just, I don't need that kind of evidence. I'm more logical, I think, than anything.
No, that's great. I think that's like I said, I admire your willingness to just speak the truth, even in the face of all these people who are saying that their experience is a certain way. And you're like, well, that's not matching mine. You know, I didn't always have that, you know, gumption. I had to kind of develop that because I would kind of go along with the herd too. You know, I don't think,
I mean, there were times I did go along with things like, you know, I believed in it so much that, you know, oh, Jesus is the savior and you must have Jesus. And so I kind of went toward like the whole evangelistic thing. My parents were pretty much evangelists and I kind of was like leaning toward that and like telling people they needed, you know, this, but it didn't last long because I kind of end up asking myself questions like, but this and that, and why does this not work? And what about this? And what was Jesus really teaching when he was teaching people about the kingdom of heaven? Like, what does that mean? I was always asking that question when I really delved deep. And I was like, okay, what is this Christianity all about? Like, I'm reading the Bible here. It says he was preaching the kingdom of heaven and he was, what is the other terminology? He was preaching the gospel. I'm like, okay, answer me. What is the gospel? Okay. And they'd be like, oh, that Jesus came and died and saved us. And I'm like, he wasn't dead yet. How could he preach that he was dead and he saved you? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. So what was he preaching? You know, they could never answer that for me. It never made sense.
They're like, yeah. Sharon, you're buzz killing. Stop it. What are you doing?
right, exactly.
I'm the buzz kill. People don't like that.
Even though we can't get buzz because it's evil, you're still killing our buzz.
Shut it down. Shut it down. Exactly. Yeah.
They don't like hard questions, you know?
Right. You're not supposed to ask those questions. Mm-mm. No. I love that you did, though. That's a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I like it for you though, Owen, because it seemed that it was something that was trying to kind of fix your parents' marriage. And just to give a little background on me, so you know, my parents were also young when they had me and they would fight a lot and they seem like they probably shouldn't be together, but they're still together to this day. And in 2020, when everything went crazy, that's just how we say it on the show. Toward the end of the year, I moved back with them because I couldn't work or anything. And, you know, I had been on my own for like, I don't know, over 20 years. It was pretty crazy, but to see them, like they still interact the same way. But since I'm into all this spirituality and like behavior and psychology, I got to see it from a totally different angle. And actually it was a lot more work that I had to do because, you know, once you get to a point where you think, you know, things, then sometimes you think you're better than other people, but, yeah, so I had a very similar experience too. What? When were you born? If you don't mind me asking, what year?
82.
Okay, so I was born in 76, but I have two younger brothers, so we're right in that same area. So yeah, I get it fully with that whole suburban lifestyle.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was awesome. I mean, I always looked up to the Gen Xers, like those were the kids that I looked up to. You know, skateboarding was big. And I remember when, you know, hip hop really kind of came out, Michael Jackson, and, you know, so many of those moments, like just that were very, I guess, impactful, you know, like a lot of pop stuff, you know, but, but yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I guess. Yeah. That's cool.
You were talking about like how you grew up in the church and all these things. Sorry,
No.
Took you off your.
No, that's fine. I'm just sharing. So no, yeah, I was, and I'll continue to overshare. but I was trying to think of just kind of where I left off. Probably like a high school area, right? Like a high school was so bad that after that incident in the yearbook, I took the last year off and just homeschooled, and it was all the Christian stuff or whatever. And so I did 2 years worth of school in 1 year because it was really easy, you know, frankly. We joined like a homeschool group and they had different teachers and stuff for that. And then I wound up trying to go to college early and I applied to this college in Atlanta called Atlanta Christian College. And they had rules. They had very many rules, in fact, and a lot of people were excited to just break those rules. But I went in and talked to the dean and I was like, so I'm going to be living off campus and commuting, but I smoke cigarettes. And he was like, well, you can't go to school here. So I was like, all right, deuces. So I just went back to the drawing board, took that year off and worked just construction. And then I got accepted. I decided that because I missed those last couple of years of high school, I didn't get to play high school football and I wanted to play football. So I found a school in South Carolina that would let me try out for it and for college. And I tried out for it and made the team. I think everybody made the team though, to be fair. And enrolled in this school called North Greenville College. I think it's called North Greenville University now. And I lasted 3 days on the team before I quit. and the people that I was bunk mates with, they were like suites. So I had a roommate and then I had two suite mates, and they were hilarious, really funny people. One of them was a really good guitar player. Named Billy. We called him Billy the Blur because he was so fast and he was like a bluegrass picker. And so there wasn't a whole lot to do. It was also a Christian college, so there wasn't a whole bunch to do there. And I had quit smoking because I wanted to play football. but I hung out with those two guys, Eric and Billy, who were super funny. We laughed a lot. We got kicked out of Waffle House one time. It was really funny. And I decided that I was going to learn to play the guitar instead of playing football, which I think was a good move overall. And so, I just did the 1 year there and then I transferred in. I had always wanted to go to the University of Georgia. That's where my dad went to school. We're big football fans. Our whole family cheers on the Bulldogs. It's a big thing here. I still like it. That's like one of those things. It's like, it's in your DNA. It's in your psyche. Like I was going to games before I was even born. So I wanted to go to UGA. And then I came here to UGA which is in the same town where I live now. So I left here after college and wound up moving back a while back ago. But yeah, I went to school here and met some amazing people, started playing in bands, and I was going to be, you know, in a, you know, famous band or whatever. That was my goal at the time. And we really, it was awesome. I mean, I learned a lot and wound up graduating with a degree in recreation and leisure studies from the University of Georgia.
Awesome.
So yeah, I might be the only one in my friend group that uses their degree.
I feel like I have an honorary title degree in there, leisurely studies.
It was actually, they tried to make it really hard because it sounds like such an easy degree to get. So they they would just overload us with assignments and all this kind of stuff. And a bunch of like cheesy, like, you know, group activities, name games, you know, all that stuff. I've got books and books in the other room of just all these, you know, group dynamics. But that was my pathway into positive psychology. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, I had to read Flow in that major. And that was really interesting to me. So there was a lot of emphasis on entrepreneurship, actually, and, you know, learning to just do different things and create different things, systems. You know, a lot of people who graduated actually in my class, one of my friends, she has a very big promotion business. She does music promotion. There was another guy who did a lot of like recreational kind of stuff, started his own business. There was another guy who was a chef, started his own business. So there was, I did learn a lot from it, even though it sounds like such a joke major. It was still actually pretty cool and helpful looking back. But what it really led to was when I was in school, someone came and did a presentation on their internship, which was something that we all had to do. And she had gone to this place called Costa Rica Rainforest Outward Bound School. And so I don't know if y'all know what Outward Bound is, or maybe what Knowles is, but these are like outdoor leadership schools. So they emphasize a lot of this group dynamic stuff, but also in the context of high adventure, like Costa Rica, rainforest, outward bound school. I went, you go down there, they made you take a course for learning ropes rescue, whitewater rescue, all these technical things, wilderness first responder, you know, all these really, you know, involved. It was a very involved course. And so I took that course. And then at the end of that, they would either offer you an internship or not. They didn't take everybody who took the course, but they did offer me an internship. So, so I took it and, I learned a lot from that. And what I really learned was how much that I loved river rafting. Some of the things we kind of touched on this before the show, it's like some things you try, you don't know if you're going to like it or not. You think you won't and you love it. And some things you think you're going to love and you hate it. Like scuba diving was that thing for me that I hated it. I thought I was like, oh my God, I get to get a scuba diving instruction certification and all these things, right? It was a whole list of, you know, you go through this course and you're basically a badass from going through it. You know, there was beach lifeguarding and all these things, you know? And so, you know, it whipped us all into shape. It was kind of like a boot camp type of thing for outdoor adventure. And not only that, but once you become an instructor, now you have to hold the meetings with the group. And a lot of the people who would come in were younger kids who maybe had drug problems or problems at home, you know? And so their parents were like, here's $8,000. Just get them away from me. And so we'd have to deal with those types of kids. And every night we'd have a meeting. We'd talk with them and teach them to cook in the woods or whatever it was. But I found that I really loved whitewater rafting. It scared the shit out of me. And there were a couple of times where people really almost got hurt really bad. But we got to see all these different rivers down there in Costa Rica, from the Pecuari to the General, the Sevegre, like just beautiful. It was like being in Jurassic Park.
Oh, wow.
It was gorgeous, just gorgeous. And, you know, I learned to turn a boat and I really enjoyed that. And then I was down there for long enough to kind of see what the deal was with the sort of organizational structure of the place. The guy who was running it was pretty sketchy. And, you know, we were getting paid $25 a day. So it was definitely, you weren't doing it for the money. You were doing it for the adventure and the involvement and to learn new skills and that. And so after my internship, I left and I had the opportunity to go to Peru, and I'd fallen in love too with Latin culture, you know, so much emphasis on family, so many incredible people that I met there. Like when we did through Outward Bound, when we would hike through the jungle, which we did a lot of because the guy who was running it was like, well, it's cheap. If they hike, we don't have to pay gas, you know, just load them with 40 pounds of canned food and send them in the rainforest. And so we had to go through with a Tico, because like they were the only ones who would know how to go, because the rainforest grows so fast. There's not like a trail, you know, like the trail is grown over in a week. So the next time, it would be a gringo and a Tico would be on each one of the, trips. But when we go in, we'd go to this place called Piedras Blancas, which was this remote village near the coast, near the Pacific coast. And we'd hike in to these homestays. And so there were a couple of families there, and we would just sleep in their house, and they would tell us the lore of the local, you know, their, what they believed. And they had doors and windows, but they were completely open. Like they didn't have like glass, they didn't have doors. And they said that was because the spirits would move through, you know, freely. And I'll never forget Orlando one day was like, okay, we're going to have an earthquake any day now, to signify the end of the rainy season and going into the dry season. And then we all went to sleep on the floor in our sleeping bags at night. And then sure enough, there was an earthquake at like 2 a.m. And it was nothing like what I expected. I was kind of expecting the DuckTales sort of version where the ground splits open and you're like, ah, you know, you're like trying to get your friends. But it was more like waves. It was more like, you know, the ground was an ocean or something. And that's kind of what it felt like. But it blew my mind, you know, that he was able to predict that, and that they were so in touch with their environment because there was no way in there other than motorbike, horseback, or walking. You couldn't even get a four-wheel drive into Piedras Blancas. So they were so remote. They generated their own electricity. You know, we do a chicken kill with the students, which was probably the funniest part because like first they have to catch it. And then all the vegans are like, you know, plucking
I'm
it.
Not eating.
Yeah. But they were the ones who plucked it. And then all the meat eating kids are like crying in the corner. Oh, I'll never eat meat again. Like, dude, you're so full of shit. And yeah, because like they had just never thought about it. Like we literally passed the chicken around, get in a circle, you know, once they had caught it and ask it questions or ask them the students questions. And it's like, do you think that this chicken knows what's about to happen, you know, to the students in the circle? And also do the other chickens know, you know, do they feel this like energy, this weight? And so it was very eye-opening in a lot of ways, even then. And I don't really think I'd even woke up yet at that point, but I was really, you know, just enthralled with the culture and the way of life. It was different. It was something that I hadn't experienced as a middle-class, you know, suburbs kid from kind of like a broken, disjointed home. But I wound up going to Peru after that because my sister had some friends that she went to college with, and they were like going down there for a quinceañera. And my mom was like, if you want to go, let's go. And so I met them all down there for that. And I wound up staying in Callao, which is a pretty dodgy little spot in Lima. I was there for a little while. And then I got the opportunity to just stick around and go. And I was there for maybe 6 or 7 months just to kind of check it out, learn Spanish, which, I mean, as best I could. I'm still not a great Spanish speaker by any stretch, but I was fascinated with the language, did some homestays there, took Spanish lessons, and wound up going and working in the Colca Canyon a little bit, which is down in the southern part of Peru, and kind of assimilating that culture for a little while. And I really enjoyed that as well. Again, huge emphasis on family. Went and saw a bunch of the churches that were there and learned a lot about the history of the people who spoke Quechua and the faux pas of that. It was weird. It was strange to be exotic because in Costa Rica, we were so sheltered in the outward bound world that you didn't really get out so much. But in Peru, it was like everyone, you were kind of an instant celebrity everywhere you went, you know, and all the girls would be like, why don't you have hair? ¿Por qué tienes pelo? And I'm like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. Can't answer that question. I've been wondering that myself, you know,
like, ask God. No.
One of the first things I remember really picking up Spanish wise was I was walking down the street in Lima and I heard some dude from the other side of the street say, su cabeza es un huevo, which means your head's an egg. And I put it together and I was like, holy shit, he's talking about me. But first I was like excited because I was like, I understood that, you know?
Yeah.
And then I realized I was getting burned, you know, it was like I was getting roasted. So, I mean, I don't know. Which is fine. I can laugh at myself. You know, that's a really big part of my humor and like how I like to present things too. My grandfather would pick on us and we would all pick on each other. And so it gave us, I think, as a family, a good ability to just be able to laugh at ourselves.
Have some thick skin.
Well, yeah. And that's something I've had to develop because like on the inside, I'm a very, very sensitive person. But especially when I got back, I mean, I had to develop some thick skin, you know, through what I learned in Costa Rica and Outward Bound and just traveling solo, which is you can learn a lot about yourself doing that. But even more so when I got back from there, because that's when I started getting some other opportunities and I started to learn about production and film and different things like that. When I first got back, I was just so obsessed with whitewater rafting that I was like, I'm going to do this forever. I'm going to be a raft guide. Cause I got back and I was like, I don't know what to do. You know, reverse culture shock hits hard. You know, I was definitely, I was definitely ready to come home. When I came home, I was missing home. I was homesick, and I'd been gone for probably a little over a year, maybe a year and a few months. And I was ready to come home. It was like Thanksgiving time too. So, you know, all the nostalgia, you know, and then, and so I came home, and I mean, I'll never forget it. Like I went out to dinner with like my dad and my sister, and my dad was on his BlackBerry pretty much, you know, my sister was on her phone, and I was like, wow, this is so much different, you know, than the culture that I was just in. You know, I could hear everyone speaking and understand everything they were saying around me, which was completely different. And I thought reverse culture shock was, I was laughing it off. I was like, fuck that. I can't wait to get back home, you know? But yeah, when I got back home, I just wanted to do the rafting thing. That's all I wanted to do. It's really a cool thing. And it's a whole, it's whole culture as well. You know, it's a whole lifestyle, like you're saying, van life. It's very van life. I started doing that in West Virginia because I found that the Gauley River in West Virginia was the most like badass river that you could do, or so I was under the impression of, right? Like there's certainly more gnarly stuff that you can find if you hunt it out. But as far as like commercial rivers, it's up there. And so I decided that I wanted to go to West Virginia and work on that river and learn up there. So that was my sort of next step. And I mean, I think at this point in my life, I'm really just chasing pleasure, right? Like I still haven't cracked my mind open. I still haven't, you know, I'm maybe 27, 28 years old, 20, somewhere in there. And I'm not even hitting 30 yet. So
first Saturn return.
Yeah, that Saturn return is when it happened. That's when it definitely happened, because I spent a couple of years in West Virginia doing that. And then I became a ski instructor in the winter, which was fun. You know, again, just chasing pleasure, doing fun stuff. And I started dating a girl in West Virginia, and she was from Tennessee. There was a lot of like people from other places that went there to work specifically to do the same thing, right? Like they were like, river rafting's awesome. Let's go. Woo. You know, let's flip some rafts. Cause the culture there is like, let's fucking flip it. Let's smash this hole. Let's surf. You can surf, you can flip, you can, you know, do all that stuff. Like that stuff is like kind of looked down upon in other places, but West Virginia is that wild, you know, who cares, like kind of reckless, let's throw caution to the wind, you know, get drunk every night by the fire, heat up some canned food, and just, you know, if you want a cold beer, you drink it in the morning. You know, that's the culture that West Virginia sort of offered at that time. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus here. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was.
I'm going to get all these letters from West Virginia now. Thanks.
Right. Don't come back. I'm not naming any companies or anything. But no, I mean, that's still very much sort of the culture of rafting. And it's a great lifestyle. You know, you go down the river all day, you're in the sun, cold water, right? Like, and then you get off and you tell your stories to your friends, like, oh my God, this happened. We got stuck on this rock, or we flipped here. You know, I had a swimmer or whatever, you know, and there's always great stories, and it's a great, fun, cool culture. And I loved it. I mean, I could easily want to do that, you know, for a long, long time. Just this lifestyle is so simple and fun. You don't have to worry about a cell phone, you know, even at that time, you know, these things were coming out. This is probably around 2000 and, 2000, maybe 10, maybe 11, 12. That's right around 2012 was when my Saturn return was. That's when it all happened. and I started to see a little bit bigger of a picture. But before that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of technology. We were still reading a map to drive out to Montana or wherever we were going. You know, we didn't have GPSs and all those kinds of stuff. So if you think about it, it really hasn't been that long that we've been in this world of technology, right? Only about 10 years. So I loved it. And I still do. Like, I still will raft guide some in the summertime when I can. And on the Chattooga River here in Georgia, which is stunningly beautiful. It's one of the oldest rivers in the world. And so was the New River up in West Virginia where I used to work, or so they say, right? Like, I don't know any accurate way to test it, but, but it's stunning. Like the trees are not very old because the forests have been, you know, harvested a lot with logging and stuff, but the rocks, you know, are just unbelievable, you know, like they're huge boulders and it's just gorgeous, stunning. And especially, I love it, especially in the fall, because the leaves turn and it's like oranges and reds and really bright colors. But yeah, so I was infatuated with that. And then I learned to ski and I was like, this is fucking as good as rafting. You know what I mean? Like, I loved it so much. And so we wound up going to Montana with the girl that I was with. She left a check. We kind of snuck into a cabin one night on property that we weren't supposed to watch some TV and get in the hot tub and, you know, do the things that you're not supposed to do. So they found a check that she had somehow left there, that was written to her. That was a tip from one of her, from one of her boats or whatever. And they were like, you got to get out of here. You know, you're fired. So I was dating her and I was like, oh, well, we can't come back here. What are we going to do? So we went to Montana and I worked as a raft guide there in Montana, which was really cool. And then that is where I started doing some research. So that's when my sort of awakening or my paradigm shifted really dramatically. We started to break up. You know, I was really into Ron Paul. It was 2012.
Yeah.
Me too. Hell yeah, dude. I'm still into Ron Paul. I wish we could go back to 2012 and just elect Ron Paul. The world we're living in would be so much better. But yeah, I mean, she was down with that too. She was like a libertarian too. But then I started reading like Brave New World and 1984, and I became completely insufferable. I was like, we're going down the slavery. I was Alex Jones. I was so obnoxious, and I know that I was, you know, I couldn't stop. But when I read 1984, I was like, oh my fucking God, this is the world we're living in. And I couldn't even connect with the people in my boat anymore. I just saw them as idiots, you know? It wound up just being like, it was the same family from Missouri, you know? Oh, tell us about Yellowstone, you know? And it was like every, you know, you tell the same joke, you tell the same story, you know, it may as well be the same family over and over again. And then I realized like, there's nowhere for me to go other than just being in the back of this boat, telling the same jokes and the same stories to the same people from Nebraska, you know? So that hit me pretty hard. Like, I'm 30 years old. I haven't done really anything, you know, like I've done all this cool stuff that I thought was fun, but you know, now, and I was going to propose to that girl too. Thank God we were going to get, she had won a lottery to do the Grand Canyon, which is like every raft person's dream trip. It's like a 30-day trip. You do the whole canyon. You've got everything packed. You don't, you know, you're not connected to any society, you know, but you've got everything packed and you go all the way down. So, you know, we were going to do that and I was going to propose to her on that trip. But fortunately, she started seeing another raft guide, which broke my heart. You know, like obviously I was really burnt up about it at the time, but it, you know, so I moved out of the van and into my car. So there we go. I actually had to fly home and drive back out there to finish the season. But I was reading all these books and listening to podcasts. I found Richard Grove at the time. Awesome stuff. I found Jan Irving at the time. Awesome stuff. I found Larkin Rose at the time. Still a big personal hero of mine. His books are so good. Like, they just made that movie. I got to check that out. But I think the Iron Web would have made a great movie. Like, it was such a good story as well. So a lot of those people, Stephen Corbett, the Corbett Report, I started listening to that kind of stuff and getting kind of into that world. I found that Richard Groves thing. It was called What You've Been Missing. I think it was made in like 2011. I'm sure you can still find it somewhere. And then his Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto. and it just blew my mind. It blew the doors off. I was like, holy shit, I've been lied to my entire life. The institution has totally did a number on me. Everything I know is wrong. And I just, when I came home from Montana, I just moved right into my dad's basement and just started reading Lysander Spooner and whatever I could find that kind of re-educate myself. And there were lots of YouTube videos and all kinds of stuff there. That was 2012. And so I literally just moved into my dad's basement, and that lasted a while, probably way longer than it should. And I was insufferable to him too. I can't tell you how many family gatherings I ruined just by not being able to shut up.
Yeah.
The Thanksgiving moments.
Banking system, you know, you're like, pass the cranberry sauce. Well, actually, I'm going to have to take 2% of that cranberry sauce because, you know, the banking. Yeah. But like, insufferable, dude. Just the worst. The bargaining phase. I'm sorry that it is even part of the grief process, because it is clearly the most annoying part of the healing process. You know, you go through the, was the first is like denial, and then it's, and then it's anger, and then it's depression, and then it's bargaining, and finally acceptance. I think I got that right. But like, truly, I was just the worst. but at the same time, that was a huge beginning of me being able to incorporate and understand the world around me, how it was set up against me. I went into a deep victimhood mentality from that. And that is a big reason why I was so insufferable. So I was in my dad's basement for, I don't know, maybe a year, maybe two. And my friends were like, dude, you're not the same person, you know? And I was picking up work in production, and which is something that I had done in off seasons since like 2004. And even in college, my friend was a cameraman in Atlanta. So I would get like production assistant gigs and stuff. And so I was doing that just on the side, just making a little bit of money here, assistant camera, you know, whatever, just working production gigs. But my friends were like, dude, you're not yourself. You're not, I wasn't social.
Yourself.
I mean, it was true. Like, I was going through this breaking apart.
Yeah.
And I did come back together, but like, there was just a couple of years there that I was just, it was so dark and bleak. And I'd be at these parties and, you know, these big rap parties and stuff. And I didn't care. I didn't really, there was nobody that I felt like I could talk to. I felt so isolated and so alone. Like, no one could understand what I knew. Right. And I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to be too obvious about it either. Like, I would talk to my friends a little bit, but, you know, at a certain point, it's like, they could only take so much. They didn't want to hear it. They just wanted to keep doing what they were doing. And some random person at a Hollywood rap party certainly doesn't want to hear that. You know, they're trying to have a good time, you know, like, they're stoked to be there, whatever. And so I was doing those kind of gigs on the side, and then just kind of, you know, staying at my dad's and like finally getting a smartphone around 2013, I think, is, and so that I could work these gigs. Atlanta's very difficult to navigate. Like, it's a hard city to drive around. Even if you live there, it's confusing as hell. And I don't know, it's like the city burned down, you know, we're all familiar with Gone, and then they still fucked it up, you know, it's still ruined it. But I think it has, in the South, it just has to do with property lines. So everyone's property lines were kind of weird, and so the streets had to follow that. Instead of like a lot of the cities that are newer out west, they would be laid out on a grid, because that makes a lot of sense. Why wouldn't you do that? But anyway.
But they're also squares.
Right. And it was kind of like that in South America too. Like, most of the cities were laid out in squares. I was in Arequipa for a long time, and you had the square, and then everything kind of, you know, from there, and the sprawl, you know, the further away from you were from the square, the poorer people lived the furthest away. Mm-hmm. But But yeah, so that's kind of when I woke up, and I just was consuming a ton of information at that point. And yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff I'm still pretty dead set on, you know, like I understand how the banking system works and what authority is, you know, these are still largely things. I don't know if many people think about it, but I think sometimes once we incorporate some of this, we forget that other people don't have that.
You feel like everybody knows, right? Like once you learn something, I was kind of like that with South Park. Like once South Park covered a topic, I'm like, don't you guys get it? Like South Park covered it. Come on. How can doing this? Yeah. It's
totally. Totally.
Like you guys are still drinking unfiltered water. What's wrong with you? Don't you know about fluoride? Like,
right.
Just, dude, fluoride's great.
Yeah. It's good for your teeth. Just drink it.
Oh my God. That's a sink for me, because the last few times I've been to a restaurant, I mean, I always bring my own cup of water, but sometimes I leave it in the car because I'm just like, I don't feel like carrying my freaking big giant jug of freaking water. So I decided to taste the water at some random restaurant we were at, and I'm tasting it and I'm just like, this has freaking chlorine. I can't do it. I just can't do it. Like, so I'm like, okay, fine. I guess I'll have to order an alcoholic beverage, because at least that doesn't have chlorine.
Nice. Make it a double, bartender. I've got to deal with these normies.
They don't even know that the Federal Reserve isn't Federal Reserve. Like, come on. It's so basic.
I know, right? It's like, I totally forgot you didn't know that, dude. It's so refreshing, you know, to start connecting with people, which didn't happen until years later. Like, I had to kind of, you know, integrate a lot of this knowledge and really just keep it to myself. But I started to be able to have fun again over time. Once I got through that bargaining phase and into acceptance, it was like, okay, cool. And for a while I felt like Neo in the Matrix. Like, I can see the numbers, dude, you know, like I can see through the bullshit. But you know, with that, and I think Brandon kind of touched on this too. It was like, there's, with that kind of arrogance, that's not a good place to be. That didn't help.
Right.
You know, it didn't help the way that I treated people. And I learned really quickly that, you know, solipsism is a terrible, terrible philosophy. That's when I started to get into spirituality, a couple of years after all learning all of that deep, deep knowledge and everything. And that's really shaped how I've developed now. 2013, I think, is when I moved back here. I was breaking up with my girlfriend and all that in Montana. And I was like, well, I know this place is cheap. I can go there. Maybe it was 2014. Yeah. And I can go there. It's cheap. You know, I can live my life and meet some new people, go out, you know, people. It's a fun, festive environment. It's a college town. So there's a lot of, and I had a lot of friends here just already from school. And so I started doing music again, and then I started to become an entrepreneur for the first time and learn about that. I became a tree farmer. It sounds probably cooler than it was, but we had, basically ornamental type trees, like the pretty trees that you see, that are in parking lots and different places the architects design, the landscape architects design that. And so there's a big farm of just trees, you know, oaks, maples, etc. And so I worked on that farm for a while, and I started to learn a little bit about business, but it was a lot. I was working way too much, like 60, 70 hours a week sometimes. And it was a lot of machinery. It was a lot of Roundup. You know, my initial idea was like, oh, tree farming, cool. We can sip lemonade and look at the pretty trees. But it was none of that. It was like, get there in the morning, load an entire semi truck full of trees, push it out of the mud, you know, get on a skid steer and then start digging trees out, you know, and spraying Roundup and right, you know, all that stuff. So I really didn't like it that much. And so I was doing that, after the film stuff, and I got an opportunity in 2014 for the first time. I was looking back to get it back into film. And I got an opportunity to work as a coordinator for a prank show. And that is what I did for a while. I worked in the film industry, from like 2014 through 2018. And I found a little niche, and I have still some great friends who are, prank, casting producers. And I wound up working and creating with them a lot of shows and movies and stuff. Some made it, some didn't. But like one example is, the movie Bad Trip. It's on Netflix. It's Eric Andre's movie. I coordinated a lot of the stunts for that. Did a show called Double Cross with Blake Griffin. It was on TBS. Prank Encounters was on Netflix with Gaten Matarazzo. It was kind of like a Halloween scary prank type of show. I helped with that. And so I started just because I was good the first opportunity, I got more opportunities. I was pretty well organized. I was, you know, able to coordinate things and stay, you know, relatively organized for other people. I have a hard time with it doing that for myself sometimes.
Yeah.
But when the heat and the pressure was on, I was like, do, you know, focus. Yeah. And that was one of those things too, where it's like, once you're on a production, you're their bitch for until it ends, until it's over, you know, like you don't get to do side level stuff. Like there's no, you know, go into open mics or whatever, or, you know, moonlighting of any sort. You're just, as a producer, I should say, you know, you're on that project and you are responsible for producing that project. Doesn't matter. You know, you're on the payroll for as many weeks as it takes to finish that out, whether it's in the pre-production, production, or post-production phase, and depending on what you're hired for. But I did a lot of that. And then right around 2016 is when I found the reality Transurfing book. That one specifically sticks out. I mean, so when I was tree farming, I was reading like Ralph Waldo Emerson and, you know, As a Man Thinketh by James Allen, all these old, great self-help books, because it was really like, I got to reprogram myself. You know, I was seeing other people, they were having success and I knew it was possible. I just didn't know how I would do it. And so I tried out the tree farming thing. Fortunately, you know, I'd be in on a ladder, you know, trimming trees for 6 hours, so I could listen to as many audio books as possible. So I really started to shift gears into the spirituality world, reading anything I could find on Buddhism, anything I could find on manifestation, New Age, any of that stuff, and incorporating that into the existing knowledge that I had picked up through, you know, libertarianism or whatever, I guess you would call that. And that really shifted, and it kind of, those two worlds really met in 2016 when I found Reality Transurfing. Because he does a great job of describing, it's like spiritual individualism is what Reality Transurfing is. It's the Tao in many more words. But the way that he explains groups, group dynamics, and all that stuff, it was amazing to me, because I had always kind of had an idea about that, and I learned about it in college. But the way that he described a group energy in the form of what he calls a pendulum, and then couple that with the fact that in 2016, Trump won the election with pure negative energy, right? Polarizing energy. Like if they would have just laughed him off, he would have never won. All the left had to do was like, the celebrity apprentice is running for president. That's hilarious. That's all they had to do. But instead they were like, no, he can't win. And then he fucking won, because he was a master at using that negative energy, the polarity. And I had learned through doing music. We did like a Misfits cover band thing one time in college, and there were pumpkins being thrown and beer bottles thrown at us, you know, for that show. And I learned how powerful negative energy is. And Trump was just a master at taking that negative energy and using it for his own advantage. And when I read transurfing, that's what he's talking about is pendulums, right? And how energy works. Because it doesn't matter if you're for it or against it, you're adding to that energy, whatever it is. If you oppose it or if you're promoting it, it doesn't matter. You're creating it. So that woke me up to a lot of kind of like how the world works, right? Like previously, before that, I thought maybe there's some dude with like a, you know, a joystick with the claw that's kind of controlling everything, you know, like that's how all this has worked. But when I read transurfing, I was like, holy shit, it's energy. That's what it is. It's energy, it's clustered energy. And there are even pendulum networks of like all these things and all these systems. And he talked about, you know, where it's all leading to and all that. And at the end of the book, he talks about giving up the fight. And he talks about, hey, man, you don't have to change the world. Like, that's not your job. And so that was a huge string, you know, that I could finally let go of. Yes. And that was really, that was really a relieving time and a time where I really felt like I had incorporated a lot of the spiritual knowledge and also, you know, political and social ideas that I had been kind of amassing over those several years. So I felt a lot more free. And then of course, like, you know, 2018 after the prank show, it kind of got a little weird. So a friend of mine was like, hey, let's start a podcast. Let's do our own thing. And so we started writing sketches and it was like a radio sketch show, a la maybe like Saturday Night Live, where there was a musical component. There was a stand-up comedian we'd clip up. And then we'd write sketches and kind of have everybody read, you know, kind of like one of those old timey, you know, kind of shows. And we had so much fun with it that I was like, I love doing comedy. I don't want to just produce it. I want to do it as well. And so that's when I started to do stand up. And then I got a call from a buddy of mine later that year who was like, hey man, you want to come and spend the winter in the Caribbean on a cruise ship with the Impractical Jokers and Kiss and all these other bands? And I was like, yeah, let's go, you know? So I got the opportunity to go and perform and mostly just host, you know, different events and stuff, which is it's a valuable skill to be able to host. And I got to do some comedy too, but I got to meet some incredible people and make a bunch of cool relationships. And that was my winter gig. And then 2020 happened and we were actually out on the cruise ship for the Impractical Jokers in 2020 when in March when that whole thing started. So I came off the boat during all of that. We were making jokes about it on the boat. So then, you know, 2020's here and all that kind of stuff. I think that kind of brings us more or less up to speed as far as if is there anything I should overshare more about? I feel like I'm talking a lot and I apologize.
Oh, no, you're doing great. I do have a quick question though. So what was your mind frame like in 2020? Like you must have obviously knew it was a prank. It must have been
right
being on a prank.
Yeah, I felt like I was being pranked. You know, yeah, I'm the one, right. You know, once again, Super Beta as we wave on. You know, yeah, exactly. I got punked by the universe. No, I mean I felt like because I had a buddy on the ship and we were making podcasts on the ship and doing, you know, a lot of really exciting things. And I, at that time too, was, you know, working with the transurfing people. And that is a whole other story that for another time, but like he and I were like, man, this is awesome. You know, we're doing comedy with, you know, Chris DeStefano and, you know, all these huge names, Ryan Hamilton, people who had massive Netflix specials and shaking hands with them, hanging out with them. Jim Brewer was on the ship, nicest guy. And so here we are, you know, and we're like, the only thing that separates us from them is just time. It's just time. You know, I made friends with Martin Urbano. He's like, come hang out with me in New York, dude, you know, whatever. It's all good. And so I was getting these opportunities. And so for me, like 2020, like 2020 vision, baby, this is going to be the year. And I was so excited. And just like, I felt like I was on just the perfect sort of wave of fortune. And then everything just started falling apart. So, yeah, I mean, at that point, I really felt like I was really in an amazing situation. And I had probably more opportunities than I deserved to have with the limited experience that I had at that point, but I was excited and I was using it in a responsible way. You know, I wasn't, I had learned through all those TV productions and things, just how to deal with people and how to be a good producer. You know, like, the way I left MGM was kind of bittersweet, but I got a lot of skills, you know, like I learned how to produce and I knew how to set things up. Like prank production is probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do because no one can know, right? Like I've got to convince people, random people, to come and do a certain weird thing that they've never heard of, right? Like under some crazy, stupid lie or guise, right? Like I'm basically catfishing them, you know, to come and do something. And then afterwards, once they get pranked, I got to get them to sign. You know what I'm saying? Like they haven't even signed yet. So I got to be like, okay, well, we promised you $20 an hour. Here's $20 an hour. Please sign this. You know, and it's like some people, honestly, it went better than I could have expected overall, but I learned a ton of skills as far as like talking on the phone to people, you know, how to hire people for things and how to, you know, coordinate certain things and all the little things. Because if one thing goes wrong, they see one wire. They're like, what's going on? If they have any one question or inkling that they could be on TV, we're burnt. You know, we gotta have people actually in waiting, standing by, you know, just in case these marks get burnt, and they call them marks. You know, I didn't feel great about a lot of that stuff. It didn't feel, you know,
honest.
Yeah. It felt kind of dodgy, right? Like, but the lawyers are like, as long as you do what you say to the, like, as long as you pay them what you say you're going to pay them and blah, 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 then, you know, it's fine. And most people were super cool. There were only maybe two or three people ever who had an issue. And then it would usually be later after they had taken selfies with the talent. They're like, we took a bunch of selfies with Tiffany Haddish and, you know, and Eric Andre and Lil Rel and, you know, by the way, we don't want to be in the movie anymore. And I'm like, well, you should have said that before you signed the paper. I mean, I can refer you to the people to talk to or whatever, but there's really nothing I can do. I'm just some underling, you know, anyway, right? I'm just the guy who gets the brunt of everything. And the other folks are in some ivory tower in Hollywood, right? Like they don't care. But yeah, I got to see the inside of that industry and it was pretty interesting to say the least, right? Like, I learned a lot about it, from the inside, and it wasn't something I felt great about. So when my friend approached me and said, hey, let's just do our own thing, I was like, yes, absolutely. Let's do that. You know, I don't want to keep doing this anymore. If it's going to be, you know, if people are going to get treated that way, you know, it's like the whole history of pranks is like first Canon camera came out and people were pissed because there was no reveal when it first came out. But when you show the reveal, people are like, oh, okay. So they find out later, but the spying on people, you know, in 1990s, imagine how people reacted to that. Mm-hmm. What, you've been filming me, right? Like now we just film everything. So people don't care, but like, yeah, without the reveal. And so that's what they learned. And so for that particular movie, it was kind of a mix of pranks and acting. So they would do pranks in the movie. So there were no real reveals in that movie. And so it kind of went back to that. And so people would feel very used, you know, which they were, I mean, they were being used. Yeah. But yeah, that was something that I did for a few years off and on, you know, from like 2014 to 2018. And then as soon as we started doing our own stuff and I got offered the boat and all that. And then when 2020 happened, I was like, well, I thought I would never do anything, you know, mainstream Hollywood again, but I did wind up getting one gig. It was like talent wrangling or something like that. And on your little thing, you could check, you know, did you get the jab, you know, it was like yes, no, or I choose not to answer. And I was just, I choose not to answer, you know. It's like they tested us like crazy, but it's like I don't know how they could legally force people to do that. But I saw a lot of people who are also very rah-rah in that industry. And then from what I've seen of it, you know, the pride that people have to be working in that industry, it doesn't sit well with me. You know, like, you're kind of responsible for brainwashing the masses. I don't think that's really something to be so proud of, you know. So doing independent stuff is kind of more where my head is now. And especially since the pandemic, and then the pandemic, when it happened, I was like, I got to figure something out. So I took the little bit of a following that I had on YouTube and from reading those books, and I did some coaching. And then this past year I started a cleaning business, which I'd always had Airbnb side hustles. And it just makes sense to just have a cleaning business, you know, because we were doing, that's 90% of doing Airbnb.
Yeah, is cleaning, absolutely. Places.
So, yeah. So I set up that whole infrastructure, and I took and used a lot of the skills that I've learned through production in order to be able to do that. So that's what I do. That's my day job, is basically just answering the phone, you know, talking to people and coordinating their cleans and stuff. And so I'm doing that during the day, and then stand up at night. And every once in a while, when some awesome people want to hang out and chat and let me share their story with them, then I'll be able to do a cool podcast like this, you know? So I cannot complain. I got a spot tonight. I did two spots last night. I mean, you know, it really did feel like the world was caving in on itself in 2020. But what I've been able to do now feels really good, because I'm building a community in Athens, Georgia. The Atlanta comedy scene is much different than what we have here. The scene here is very supportive of each other, and very, very loving. They're roasting me on Friday. They're doing a roast of me, you know. It's like, funny. I started an Instagram page where I just posted all the shows that were going on, and encouraged other comedians to start shows, you know, start producing shows. Because if you want to get into the industry, the mainstream industry, first of all, good luck. You know, like, there's a million. It's like I did a mic on Sunday where all these people are basically trying to get in as a host at this comedy club. And it's like, even if you do get in as a host at that comedy club, do you think anybody walking out of that club is going to follow your Instagram? They're there to see the TikTokers that they came to see and get their meet and greet. And that's it. You're living in 2003, man. It's 2023. If you can't do it with your phone, I'm sorry, but it's just not going to happen for you. Like, the people who are selling out comedy clubs are not even comics. They're just random people. Their audience, their fan base, comedy illiterate. They can't even pay attention to a one-liner. They don't even know. Their attention's gone, right? Like, they're scrambled from TikTok. So it's not the way to go anymore, right? It's 2023 now. So what we need to learn to do is to find our audiences, you know, and to lean into that. And so I've tried to build a community here, because that's something that's, I don't know, I enjoy that. It's something that I love and love being a part of. So it's kind of like it's an honor, really, for comedians to just berate you and humiliate you in public. That's how we show love for each other, right? So on Friday this week, they're doing a roast of me at this little spot that we do a lot of open mics and stuff at. And one of the things I would have loved to have done would have been to start a comedy club here, but I think it's actually worked out better that we haven't, because we don't have to worry about the overhead and all the bar management. You know, it's like, we come in, we produce a show, and if we have things get weird at that venue, we're out. We're just going to go to another venue.
Right.
So it's been really fun and really edifying. Like, and I don't know, I feel like I'm doing the things that I'm on the path and doing the things that I should be doing. And I feel really good about it. You know, I'm not like pranking a bunch of people, or doing like disingenuous things to try to get stage time. You know, we're creating our own scene here, and I want to continue with that. And I think it will continue to flourish, assuming, you know, there's not some crazy side swiping thing that happens. And one thing I wish I could go back to the pandemic time too, because that shit fucked me up. I started like eating ice cream at 3 p.m. in my sweatpants. You know, I didn't go crazy on alcohol like a lot of my friends did, but I didn't go, I went horrible on my health. I didn't, you know, I just got so depressed from that. And I don't know, I'm reading a lot of books just in like how to cultivate, you know, strong mental processes and fortitude and stuff like that. One of the guys I'm reading his books now, his name is Trevor Mawad, Mowad. He wrote a couple different books. One's called It Takes What It Takes. The other is Thinking Neutral. And Thinking Neutral probably has as much to do or in common with reality transurfing than any other book that I've ever read. And this dude worked with the top of the top of athletic people. Like he worked with Nick Saban, the coach at Alabama, Kirby Smart, the coach here at Georgia, you know, Maria Sharapova, like Vince Carter, Russell Wilson, and the Seahawks, all these people, and training their mental state and ability. So to me, that's what I'm kind of like really interested in now as well, you know, and I've got some health goals now. I don't know, maybe it was turning 40 that kind of hit me and I'm like, all right, I need to, you know, I feel like shit. I can't be eating ice cream at 3 p.m. It's not going to cut it. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm at, you know, with things that and writing, you know, so I don't really do a whole lot of like consuming stuff like I used to, but I do want to watch Larkin Rose's movie and I do want to watch Matt Rife's movie that just came out because Jimmy Schubert's in it, who's a comedian that's not very well known, but I really like. I think he's a fantastic comedian, and Jamie Kennedy's in it, the dude who had he talk about pranks. I mean, that dude was doing pranks in early 2000s and just crushing. But, and I like Jamie Kennedy a lot too. I'll say, but yeah, I mean, but I love creating and producing, and I'm hoping to have a series of things out comedy wise this next year with a friend of mine. And that should hopefully be dropping in the new year. So I'm really excited about that. And just doing independent stuff and encouraging more people to do independent stuff. Cause that's the way, only way. Like there's no going this traditional route anymore. It's over. You're not getting a sitcom, bro. And even if you did, it would be so hack and nobody would watch it. And it would just be, you know, like who cares? Like that's so lame. So, you know, I want to encourage people to do their own thing and yeah. And just, you know, find what makes them happy. What makes them feel fulfilled, you know, find their icky guy, you know, their, what the world needs, what you're good at, what you can be paid for and what you enjoy doing and put that matrix together and start to live as purposefully, you know, as they can. I try to encourage people and just try to stay as positive as possible. One of the things that Trevor Mawad says in his book is that the biggest goal is just to not say stupid shit out loud. You know, maybe you have a few bad thoughts or whatever. Just don't fucking say it out loud. And that is a huge thing. That's what changed the culture at Alabama University, who's won 12 national titles or some shit. Wow. Stupid. Like, it's like, if you're going to say, if you can think negative and that's okay, you know, don't beat yourself up for it, but just don't let yourself say the negative shit out loud because that's how it really starts to unravel. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember back in the day, like I would just be like, I would come undone, you know, one negative thing would happen and it would just be this spiral that just unwound.
Downward spiral. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome. A lot of stuff you talk about is stuff that Brennan and I talk about on the show all the time. I have a question for you. How did you get the nickname Bootsy Greenwood?
So that's my stripper name. if you don't know, everyone has one, right?
Tactic and method did you use to come up with
that? So the one that I always learned was it was the first pet you ever had, their name, and then the street you grew up on. So Bootsy was a cat we had and then Greenwood Drive. So that's how I derived it.
That's funny.
Yeah, it gets a laugh every time. And I was like, why are you guys laughing?
Yeah.
What's so funny? but yeah, like that's my open, you know, and
that's funny.
Scene, so, you know, and I'm like, you know, I would give you guys a demonstration, but I don't think this, this pole is going to hold my weight. You know what I'm saying? That's, my stand on the stage is probably not going to do it, but yeah, I'll probably be releasing, cause I have to anyway, release some sort of a tape for this, festival thing that I'm doing. It can't be unlisted. I'm really hesitant about putting out stand-up stuff. Like, I like to keep that, you know, buried, frankly, until I'm ready to release a special or do something different. And I want to do something different, but we want to burn it. We want to burn the content. I want to burn is sketches. I think sketches top of the mountain anyway. You know, the Whitest Kids You Know, and with Bob and David, Mr. Show, Saturday Night Live, that to me, that's the best, because you can just do so much with a sketch. Mm-hmm. And with stand-up, you got to tell them.
Yeah.
And I wasn't 100% even sold on stand-up until the pandemic, because I was doing a lot of improv and stuff. And I love improv. I'm probably a much better improviser than I am a stand-up. Mm-hmm. But that takes four people, you know, and everybody had different political leanings, four people at least, maybe usually it's eight's an ensemble, but it's like everybody had their different ideas. And I'm like, well, you know what? If I do stand up, no one else can dictate shit. If I'm free on Tuesday, I'm free, you know? So I've kind of gone down that world, but I'm excited to start doing some more sketches again. I will be releasing some of that stuff. So, some of the things that we talked about even before the show will be coming out next year, and should be really fun.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's, I'm really glad that you shared all that stuff with us. It's really interesting to see other people's journey through this time frame, and to kind of match up your own. And a lot of people that listen to this show have not like similar stories, but I guess you could say kind of similar with the way that they woke up and stuff. So it's cool. But also to hear all that stuff about comedy and being almost like behind the scenes with all these people. Yeah, that's awesome, dude.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and funny that the paths that some people have are very similar, or, you know, have some salient features that are similar. But it's interesting that we, at least the people that follow our show, usually kind of arrive at a very similar outlook. And I find that fascinating.
I had a pretty weird dream the other day. I think there's a lot to dreams too. I have a friend who's very, very talented with that. She taught her kids to lucid dream so that they could, you know, not be taken by their nightmares, so that they
are
could...
You talking about Abby?
Abby Johnson. Yeah, my buddy. Okay. Abby. Amazing.
Yeah, Spoons told me about that you're friends with Gordy and Abby, and that you've had them both on your show. I haven't watched them yet, but Gordy was on our show too. We love Gordy.
I love him too. I love him so, too.
Yeah, tell us about the dream thing you were gonna say. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine. No, it's awesome. Like, I love those folks. But yeah, Abby, she's so talented, and she helped me to learn to interpret dreams and stuff. So she's really good at that and the lucid stuff, but you know, there's kind of advantages to both. But I had a dream a few nights ago. It wasn't even that long ago, where I was driving like through all these interstates, and then all of a sudden there's like a Bigfoot there, and I was like, oh shit, that's crazy. And then another one. And then, so I pull into this like parking garage, and then all these jokers from like Batman come out, you know, and they're like scaring the shit out of me. And I was so scared and so afraid. And at a certain point in the dream, I realized I don't have to be scared. You know, I'm actually at the cause of whatever I do right now. Yeah, the situation might be fucked. It might be, but I still have control.
Absolutely.
You know, over what I'm going to do. And so that's really stuck with me. And, Trevor Mawad stuff, I highly, highly recommend to anybody who's, you know, wanting to work on their mentality. He even does an experiment on himself where he listens to a bunch of country music and exposes himself to the 24-hour news cycle and like all this stuff. Cause the way he grew up, his dad was kind of a legend in self-help and positive psychology. Mm-hmm. So he grew up in that world. So he was already predisposed to it. Nice. Then he does the opposite sort of experiment on himself and he couldn't even go 30 days before.
Oh my gosh, I would go nuts.
So, you know,
I can't even do 5 minutes. Yeah,
I can't either anymore. Right. Like I can't, I just can't. Yeah. I mean, people send me clips and I'm like, I can't even.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Me too.
You're going to tell me I'm a piece of shit because I'm not taking a side on this. There's nothing I can do. I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, like, right. No. I'm not engaging in this. And the things that I want to talk about on stage anyway, aren't really that topical. I mean, I love talking about philosophy, but I don't really want to talk about what happened this week, you know, and current events. I just, that's not exactly interesting. It's not evergreen either. You know, my favorite comedians are evergreen. I can listen to Bill Hicks right now and it's still as pertinent today as it was when he said
Classic.
And Mitch Hedberg too.
I was just going to say Mitch Hedberg. Oh, there you go. That's a sink. Yeah. I was actually thinking of even doing a Mitch Hedberg impersonation. You know, I could just like put my hair in front of me and stand up there. And I've even written a couple of my own original Mitch Hedberg jokes. So
that's awesome. I would love to see that.
Yeah. Awesome,
Hedberg. You two could collaborate on some comedy stuff.
Yeah, I was going to tell you before we left, if you ever need an extra person, especially if they look like Jesus, you know, just let me know. Yes,
or a wizard.
Or a wizard, yeah. You know, all that.
You have a good Bigfoot look too, man. You know, 100%.
I'm 6'5", too, so I mean, it's hard. Yeah, that's what I mean. So
we've nicknamed him Brandoff the Gray.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, that's one of the weddings I did recently. They got me a wizard's cap. So when
you were gonna wear it?
Yeah, I was when I did the introductions and stuff and. I got to talk like in front of people. I introduced myself as Brandoff the Gray. And I was like,
that's awesome. Yeah. Let's definitely stay in touch. I mean, I'm definitely down to collaborate. I want to make stuff, you know, I'm fortunate enough that we got to meet this lady who has a really big following. She's from Athens. And so she found me through the Instagram thing that I've been posting on. I just share everyone who's coming to town. I share clips of them. I share the schedule. I made a little website with a calendar on it, you know, just to try to help everybody out. And she found me and then she wound up coming to do a workshop for us. Well, she has like 200,000 on Instagram or something. I don't even know how many she has on TikTok because I don't have TikTok, but it's a lot. And YouTube, she's doing real well. She's got a couple of dry bar specials. Her name's Karen Morgan. She's very funny, but she has her own specific style of comedy and her own demographic that she is working toward and making content for. And the biggest thing that she said to us, and if I could sum up her workshop, it was like, you're not competing against each other.
I love that.
You're not. And she's exactly right. She's so right. Because it's like, you're making content for the people who are in your niche.
Exactly.
The more you
focus on that. That's what Brandon and I do on the show.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, it's great. It's what a lot of these independent creators do. You know, like the people in the Alt Media United, like Legit Bat, you know, and all these other different podcasts. I love Andy Rouse's show, The Deep Share. You know, I just love him, you know, and Abby's been on Project Cheney's new show, the Secret Society of Good Guys, you know, and they're doing their own thing. And so I really appreciate that. You know, Sam Tripoli started doing it with the tinfoil hat thing in like 2018 and it became so much bigger than I think he probably would have ever expected it to. But it's a very specific thing. And I don't really listen to that podcast anymore, but I loved it when it came out because it was so fun to hear him like come to the same conclusions. And he's such a like animated person, like, wow, you know, like, so you would see him like get this revelation and it would crack me up. I'm like, and I'm cheering him on. I'm like, yeah, dude, Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's somebody I'm talking about.
You get it.
It's either federal and it's out of reserve.
Exactly. So yeah, I'm 100% down to collaborate. And the guy that I'm going to be working with too, next year is 100%, you know, in the realm. And so, so I'm really excited about that. I really want to expand the sort of comedy, whatever it is that we are, non-group, the non-group group.
Yes. The non-labeled, the unlabeled group.
Yes, exactly. As you know, as much as we can, I really think there should be, you know, a representation from the independent creators and independent comics and other people who, you know, I don't want to create an echo chamber either. I don't think any of us are interested in that, but just by helping each other who are wanting to be autonomous and collaborative at the same time.
Yes.
And so 100%, let's definitely collaborate.
Great news to hear about stuff like that.
I think that's so too. I think it happens organically too, you know, cause like that was one of the things that Karen said too. She was like, you don't want to like make things obligatory,
yes,
you know, to where it's like, you've got to be here at this time and you've got to do, cause it should still be fun. Absolutely. You know what I mean?
And absolutely.
I've dealt with that in the past where things just don't get fun. They get unfun and you're just like, oh,
I've been thinking about that. Cause that's kind of what, I went through a lot of that stuff where I was like interested in groups, like, oh, I was interested in going back to church at one point and like, you know, interacting with that. But then I just noticed like, okay, as things are really huge, that's too many people. That's too many thoughts, too many ideas. And especially if it's an echo chamber and then they don't let you ask questions. And then, you know, I started looking into other groups of communities that, you know, maybe I could resonate with. And then I found people that were kind of into the lawful topics, you know, and so I was kind of getting involved in those. But then it was like obligatory to join this and do this and you must. And I'm just like, I can't do that. I have to be independent. I have to have freedom. I have to go if I want to go, not because I'm forced to go. I can't do that kind of stuff. So I love this. Just going to, or collaborating with people who are just like, you know, be there if you can, be there if you want, contribute what you can, just enjoy, you know?
Yeah, I really think like that. Yeah, there's a naturalness to it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, I love the way that Larkin Rose would talk about anarchy, you know? And it's like when four people arrive at the stop sign at the same time, you know? Like, it's not necessarily going to be a disaster. You know, there's a natural order. There's a natural process. And ride that wave. And transurfing is like that, too, where, you know, he talks about the wave of fortune and the bluebird of happiness. It's like, as soon as you try to grab the bluebird of happiness, it flies out of your hand. You can't do that. You have to leave your hand open. You know, you have to appreciate and admire that flower in the field. As soon as you pick it and put it in a vase, it's going to die in 3 days. It's over.
I never freaking understood that growing up. I was like, why do people give people flowers? They're going to die.
And like, why do people pause? I'm so sorry. I don't.
I'm like, I don't get it. And so
deal with flowers?
I'm like, I don't know what to do. If somebody gives me flowers, I don't know what to do with it. Because I'm just going to stick it in a vase with water. And then what? It's going to die. So I feel bad.
Absolutely. If you leave them be out there, they'll come back every year. And you'll get to see a beautiful flower every time. It's like caging a wild animal. Like, I don't know why we want to do this. You know, it's a bad idea.
I was going to say I have thoughts on pets that are very similar to that. And I don't want to talk about it because people will get triggered.
But yeah, we have a list of topics that we're going to do a secret show about that might just be for us. And one of them is, and it's funny because I have two cats and within the past about year, 2 years, I've became friends with a woman. Now we live together. You know, we're going to get married and all this stuff. And she had two cats. So now we have four cats. But Sharon has this, well, we'll just say an idea we've talked about ourselves with pets, how it's kind of like a form of escapism sometimes, you know. And again, we're not judging anybody with pets. And we understand when you give a pet a home or whatever. But we have this whole, like, we could do that as a bit, actually, maybe, you know, like, I don't know. Because people would get so offended, but then we'd have to have some kind of comedic release to it.
Yeah, and I just can't see the, like, why put an animal? I mean, people are like, well, it's already domesticated. I'm like, okay, fine then. But, like, that's your thing. Like, if you want to have it, fine. But I'm just talking about me. I can't see myself putting that in a place where only humans live. Like, they have to poop. They have to do all this, their stuff. It's like, I don't want them pooping in a little box in my house. That's gross. Like, that's disgusting to me. Like, why? I thought to myself, like, when I had to watch my ex-boyfriend's cats, when he went off to visit his mom in Pennsylvania, and it lasted a couple of weeks maybe, and I was just like, when are you coming back? Because this is so disgusting to me, because like all I smell is cat litter and it's so gross. But I was like, I can't. The guy who invented cat litter boxes, indoor cat litter boxes, is the most retarded guy ever. Like, if cats are so fucking intelligent, why didn't you teach them to go out fucking side? Jesus fucking Christ. Sorry, that's a kind of like a.
I tend to agree. Yeah, my grandmother was emphatic, like no pets in the house. Like, yeah, she was emphatic, like, that's me. About that.
That's me. You know?
And I love animals.
I love them too. But people don't get that about me. They're like, I like how you don't have pets. I'm like, I love them. I love to go see them and pet them and stuff, but I don't need them to be in my house. Like, if I lived on a freaking ranch and there was tons of property where they could live, fantastic. But I cannot have them in the space of my house. That's, to me, hair everywhere. That's just gross. I can't.
Oh, my friends had a pet goat for a while, and I'll never get the image out of my head of that goat just walking through the living room and my friend behind it with a shop vac, just vacuuming up the shit just immediately. You know what I mean? No, it's like,
I mean,
what are you guys doing? Like, right? They were being silly anyway, but
it's like they're becoming slaves to that. Like, who's the ruler now, you or the pet?
Yeah. And I'm with you.
Bending over.
I'm with you.
Picking up. I'm like, oh my God. Sorry.
And part of it for me too is like, I want to be able to travel too. And so that's kind of frustrating to have to deal with all that. So I've never had, you know, that. But we didn't have many pets growing up. My grandmother was such a neat freak. And,
So what was Bootsy then?
Bootsy was a cat, but he went outside to poop. He didn't poop in the house. And my mom, like, it was my sister's cat that my mom wound up taking care of.
As it happens.
And he wound up being like a road cat. Like, he would, like, she would take him to like the, they would pull off on the, you know, rest areas, and he would get out and walk around and poop business. And just get back in the truck.
Like, hilarious.
Yeah. He was one of those. Yeah.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Awesome.
Well, we ended up talking about it now. We don't have to have a secret show about it.
I think your perspective is not out. I think it's fine. It makes sense to me. I've got a friend who's got a dog, and I'll let him bring the dog over here for the most part. But then sometimes it's like, dude, I've got an Airbnb person coming through. It's like, I got to rent my house out, you know, until X amount of time. You know, don't bring Ella over here. I love her. But I don't, you know, somebody could complain and then it ruins my, you know, Airbnb rating, you know, or whatever. So anyway, but yeah, obviously you don't, you love animals. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And I know some people who are like, you know, vegan PETA people who are like, no petting zoos or no, you know, they're completely, you know, emphatic about certain things. And I understand their points too. You know, I get it.
Yeah, I'm not saying I don't understand people's points of views. I mean, I get it. I'm a Libra. I see both sides, you know, but I just choose for me. I'm like, don't judge me for choosing for me. Like, you do you.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you go to Latin America, like, there's just wild dogs and wild cats everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not, that's a very very common thing.
They're smart. They can do their thing.
They know what to do. They've been surviving for hundreds and probably thousands of years, you know, without any assistance.
And we think we can domesticate them and make them do what we want. It's like, okay.
I think they are the boss. I really do. Like, that's how you're accurate in your assessment.
But I'm not judging anyone.
Same. I don't need anybody coming after me either.
Fido heard your podcast and he's so pissed off.
No. Oh man.
Well, I guess we could probably wrap things up. I have just a couple of questions for you regarding, you talked about audio books that you did. And I think Spoons told me you did one on the Tao. Are these still available on your channel? Or do you have like multiple channels?
Yeah. I've got a bunch of audiobooks on my YouTube channel. I've got Emerson's Self-Reliance is one of my favorites. I put that out years ago. And the Tao is one I put out a couple of years ago. There's a little moment in the Tao where I just got tickled and started cracking up laughing. Probably should have edited that out.
Funny. That's whatever. Awesome, though.
It's still there.
That's awesome. Spoons told me about that. She's like, there's a point where he lost it.
I did. And I didn't cut it out. I just left it in the edit.
That's awesome. Perfect. I love it.
Those who know don't talk. Those who talk don't know. Why am I doing this?
Oh, you'll notice. You'll know where it's coming. You'll see it coming in there. But yeah, that's available on my channel. I've got Khalil Gibran, The Prophets on there. There's a ton. I've got a whole playlist.
That's how you say it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Whose version of the Tao did you read?
Oh, yeah. Good question.
Remember? So it was the same version that I found that there's a really good recording of. Let me look it up and I can tell you real quick.
Did you know that Aleister Crowley has his own version of the Tao?
I did not.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. We've been covering the Tao, and we'll go through and do an episode when we don't have a guest right now. So what we're doing, we'll cover two different verses, and we have four versions. And Sharon, the Aleister Crowley version, and it reads like a cult or like King James Bible. Like, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's very like Kabbalistic, hermetic, esoteric.
That's cool. I want to check it out. I want to check out a bunch of translations. There was just this one that I found on YouTube, and it's just done so well. The guy's voice is awesome, too.
Is it Stephen Mitchell?
It's Stephen Mitchell.
Yeah.
That's Brandon's favorite version of the Tao.
So good. And there's like water underneath it. Yeah. And that guy's voice is so calm.
Yeah, whatever happened to that guy.
Oh man, I have no idea, that is my favorite version that I've heard, but I need to check out some of the other versions.
Well, we do four versions in our little dissection that we're going through. So, you can check out the four versions that we use in ours.
And Stephen Mitchell is one of them.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. I don't think it'd be interesting to contrast those, but yeah, I love that book so much. It's so good.
And it came out in 1984, right? Wasn't that the...
No, was that Stan Rosen? That's 80. Was it 88 or 84? One of them.
I'm not sure. I just have to look at my slides and I could tell you real quick.
Yeah, I was going to say we have the...
It was 1980. Stephen Mitchell's 1988 and Stan Rosenthal's 1984.
Stan Rosenthal.
So we do Stephen Mitchell, Dwight Goddard, Stan Rosenthal and Aleister Crowley. We read those four versions.
Okay. I'm
just as a comparison.
Right, yep. I got it queued up.
Yeah. A lot of people though. It's interesting because one of our friends, he goes by Sarcastic Warlock. I'm not sure if you've bumped into him or heard of him, but he is pretty into, not like super into Crowley or whatever, but he's into all kinds of stuff. But he didn't know that either, that Crowley had his version of the Tao.
Yeah. It surprised me when I came across it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. For sure. No, I'm excited to check that out for sure. Thanks.
It's our little reveal that we do to people.
Very cool.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, where else can people find you?
Sure. So bootsygreenwood.com. And I'm Bootsy Greenwood on all the platforms. I have a Blue Collar Mystics Instagram, and then I run the Athens Comedy Instagram, Facebook, and web page there. So if people want to go ahead and give that a follow, you'll be able to see clips of all the different comedians that come through. Theo Von came through, and John Mulaney came through. We have a great scene here, and you know, I'm mostly booking, you know, smaller comedians and stuff, but I try to make it really accessible and try to showcase all the different comedians that are coming into Athens, what we call the classic city. So people can follow that. I appreciate it. And then I'm Bootsy Greenwood everywhere. So my name, birth name, Owen Hunt, which got sadly misspelled, Is the same name of a character from a famous TV show called Grey's Anatomy. So kind of Google credit. That's why I went with the stripper name. So, that's the
good
whole
call. Yeah, right. Good call. I yeah, like I it.
Buried in the algorithm otherwise.
I mean, who? No one else is going to be called Bootsy Greenwood.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to outswagger Bootsy Collins or anything. So I think we're good. We have different niche.
Know who that is.
he's a bass player, and he's incredible okay. for That's Parliament funny. Funkadelic. But yeah, I'm doing comedy. He's doing playing the bass.
So.
Did you play? You said your dad. Did you say your dad played the bass?
Yeah, and I did too. Actually, when I was playing in bands, I did play the bass also. That's but funny. But yeah, he was a bass player for sure, and he was a good one too. Man, I remember. Big music family, big art family. Yeah. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having us, Brandon. You want to shout out to the live chat?
So every Thursday when we premiere these, if we're not live, we have a chat that we hang out in, and shout out to you guys. Thank you guys for hanging out to the end. Thank you so much. Thank you for anybody that might have came and seen us because of Bootsy Owen. That might not have seen us before. Thank you guys for checking us out. Check out our other stuff, our website, morelawsmoreproblems.com, the website that I've had now for 10 years. That's part of my little waking up thing. Speaking of waking up, and you can click on the oversharing tab. There's several ways to support us there, but we always tell people the best way to support us is to come out and hang out with us every Thursday in the chat. You know, subscribe, tell your friends about us, overshare, share and share on. And what do we say to the good people, Sharon?
That once you start oversharing,
then you totally stop being a Karen.
That's right.
That's right. And remember, we're not telling you how to live.
Just maybe how to live a little more simply.
That's right. And we'll see you guys next week. Thanks again, Owen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Owen.
For checking us out.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you all so much.
Bye.